And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, the best-selling author and teacher of writing, Brett Locke, has came to Chapel Hill to talk about his new book, Dead Low Tide. And he also came to talk with a church group about his collections of short stories with religious themes, and how his own religious beliefs affects his life and his writing. And Brett Locke, it's great to have you in Chapel Hill.
Great to be here. Glad to be back.
Well, can we talk about Dead Low Tide? It's just come out.
Let's talk about it.
And there is a Chapel Hill connection. Chapel Hill connections.
What are the two Chapel Hill?
Well,
one is
that
UG, you know, went there.
UG, yeah, tell us about
UG.
This is a sequel to another book, and UG,
yeah.
Between the time
UG,
of the first.
UG, pronounced UG.
UG.
It's okay.
You should know this. I've been
in
the Carolinas a long time. But how's it spelled? It's not spelled.
It's spelled H-U-G-E-R. There's a whole slew of names down in Charleston that you have to be, you know,
if you say Huger, you know Huger, that you're out, you're a Yankee.
Vanderhorst. You're not from around. That comes out Vandross. That's how that comes out.
Well,
and L-E-G-A-R-E is Legree, believe it or not. So there's a whole host of names down there that you have to
figure
out.
These are the Huguenot names, I guess.
Yeah, all sorts of oddball names down there. I shouldn't say that. Well, I'm not in Charleston. I'm taping this here. Okay, so those Charlestonians aren't going to hear me say that.
UG.
Right.
Who's the main character in your book,
right.
Went to Carolina.
That's right.
Tell us.
Well, he's a character. Dead Low Tide is a sequel to a book called The Hunt Club that I published back in 98. And he's a 15-year-old kid named Eugene Dillard, and he has a blind uncle named Unc. And
that's, by the way, that's the other UNC connection.
That's the other one. Yeah.
His name is spelled UNC.
That's right.
Or
that's right.
UG calls him.
That's
his,
right.
UNC.
But wrote this 12, 13 years ago, and then subsequently wrote about, I guess, four more books, but always haunting me with this, where this was this kid named UG and his uncle, and I keep using unk and uncle with quotation marks because there's another story.
Sticking with the Hunt Club and the. This is kind of the backstory for our conversation, but the Hunt Club is a murder mystery set with characters that you want to be involved both in the story and the characters who are there.
Right, it's a murder mystery, and I generally speaking don't write murder mysteries, but I love murder mysteries, and so when I wrote the Hunt Club, I had great. Deal of fun writing it, and then I kept writing it. When I gave it to my agent said, "This is not a murder mystery; it's another Brett Locke novel," which means it's about family. I always write about family. I don't know what else to write about. So, but I had written The Hunt Club, this murder mystery, and then was haunted by these characters, and came back finally to write a sequel to The Hunt Club, and now he's Eugene's now 27 years old, and 6 years ago he got kicked out of Carolina because of he thought he was a lot smarter than he really was. It appeared he was smarter than he was, and he got up here and was lost. And so that's basically what the novel is about, is this kid who is living with mom and dad, which is a very common syndrome now.
A lot of us can identify with this situation where you got an older child who just hadn't quite found it and is trying to make his way in the household.
And that's exactly where Eugene is since he left Chapel Hill. He's back in Charleston and living with mom, dad, and kind of taking care of Unc. And he's living in this kind of malaise. And lo and behold, they find a body in the
marsh. I want you, if you will, just now.
Near the property.
This is not really giving away anything because this part of the book is the publisher's got this first part of the book up on the web where you can read it for free.
Yep.
So will you tell it for free just a little bit about this introductory part of the story, which is it's really nicely written it's a puzzle. What in the world's going on here?
Well, you always want the body to show up very, very early, and Unc and Yuji are pulling a John boat in off of Goose Creek into a very Tony property. which is by a golf course. And Unc is blind, and he's too proud to try. He wants to learn to golf, and he's too proud to do that in daytime where people might see him. And so Yuji helps him get up onto the golf course in the middle of the night and just watches him with night vision goggles to see where the balls go. And they then, as they're pulling in, Unc touches something down in the water, down in this little finger creek that pushes right up into the back of a very nice piece of property. And at first you don't really know what it is, but I hope that people figure, you know, oh, that's got to be something bad, because immediately, a little few pages later.
Why would
later,
we be talking about
right,
it if it weren't
right,
going to be?
Right. So it's discovered right away that this is a body down under there. And that sets a whole bunch of stuff in motion. And not just plot in motion, but also purpose in motion. Yuji's got to figure out, what am I doing here? Why am I not doing anything? What is the source of this malaise? And I need to get over the past. When writing this book, it occurred to me, I like to write realistic stuff. And it occurred to me that if you're going to write a series of novels about murder mysteries with the same characters, that means these people are always encountering bodies. And when you encounter a body, it occurs to me that one might be enough in your lifetime to find a dead body somewhere out in the woods. So, you know, as I said, lo and behold, here in the first chapter, they find another one. And Yuji still isn't.
But it's 10 years later.
It's 10 years later. He's still not quite over last time, you know, that this all happened. And so all this stuff comes rushing back in. And that to me was the more interesting part of trying to write about him, was to try and write realistically about somebody who finds another dead body. What do you do with that information? It forces him to remember and go through the sorts of post-traumatic stress, I guess it would be.
From the first experience, going back to the Hunt Club, there was a whole lot more than finding the body that traumatized him.
He ends up killing a man in the Hunt Club. So, you know, in self-defense, but that would still mess you up. And so as I was writing this book, I was thinking, I got to be realistic. I love realistic landscape. As you said, you can go to Google Maps and kind of trace things out. I really put supreme value on making sure that things are real, that you can see them, that I'm not going to lie to you in those
Well, it
instances.
Is. It's all of the descriptions there give you a geographic tour of the area surrounding downtown
right.
Charleston.
Right. There's no carriage tours in this.
Well, novel. These are the places. I go to Charleston. I go down to the market and run down to the Battery.
Yeah.
But there are neighborhoods that surround Charleston that are equally important, I guess, in Charleston life that you take us to in this novel. A different look in Charleston.
Well, there's the whole, you know, suburban thing about Mount Pleasant. Mount Pleasant just outside of Charleston is a very shishi, you know, neighborhood, and the place that Yuji's from is from North Charleston, which is basically the downtrodden, you know, working class, poverty stricken area. But between that was in the Hunt Club, but between the time the Hunt Club happens and the time the Dead Low Tide happens, they actually have struck it rich. And Yuji, who's poo-pooed throughout his life, poo-pooed the blue bloods and all the doctors and lawyers downtown, ends up finding out that actually I'm one of those people. And now what do I do? So that kind of compounds the whole confusion that Yuji's dealing with in terms of his, you know, his own identity. But I like writing about the stuff in Charleston that is not stuff that everybody sees, because there's so much more to it. There's a scene in the book. What happened when I'm not from Charleston. I moved there in 1986. It was my first real job. I teach at the College of Charleston. I left from 2004 to 2007. I went to LSU and was editor of an important journal called the Southern Review. And I did that for 3 years and realized I did not want to live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, when I'd been in Charleston for 18 years. And I also missed teaching. I love teaching. So I went back to Charleston. But early on in my time in Charleston, my wife and I really realized we'll always not be from here. And I love Charleston. I'll never leave. But there's an element of Charleston that says, you know, of those who are from there, you're not from here. And that's kind of been my experience as a citizen there, but also as a writer. A writer is always, to me, somebody who should be on the outside looking in rather than in the center and looking at his navel. So,
but there is a writing community in Charleston that is very in, but composed of a number of people who didn't start out there. I think about Pat Conroy first.
When he writes about Charleston, he is writing about on the outside looking in. You know, even though with South Abroad, and I love Pat Conroy, and he's a friend. It's not that great of a book, but you know, with most
all
his stuff.
How could you say that about somebody who says this great thing about?
Because I think that he's written some great books. He really has. I love Prince of Tides now I'm going to look like a fool because I'm drawing a blank.
Citadel book.
Yes,
that's
right.
Lord of Discipline.
That's
Lord
of Discipline. Yeah. That's right. I don't count. He writes about people on the outside looking in too.
Well, let me, we're going to take a break because I don't want to talk about Pat Conroy, but what about My Losing Season? You read the basketball book?
No.
All right,
is that
then we're going to take a break.
Sure.
We're visiting not with Pat Conroy. We're visiting with Brett Lott, whose wonderful book, Dead Low Tide, has just been published, and he's come to Chapel Hill to talk with us about it. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Brett Lott. We're talking about his new book, Dead Low Tide. Later, we're going to talk about some of the books that he edited of short stories with religious themes. But we've got Fred and Granville Hill with us, and they pointed out that that one of the distinctive things about the book, the Dead Low Tide book set in Charleston, is that we think it's got real geography because we can find the streets, we can follow these swamps, the naval bases, all of these the gambling house that's in Mount Pleasant. We can just follow this. We can get in the car and drive. What? Other authors, though, think it's important to have an imaginary setting so that you're don't get locked in like we did on the real geography, but you stay fixed on the. What's your theory about writing and whether or not real geography contributes to the reader's ability to follow?
It's funny that you say that because there are different writers have different ideas, and one of my best friends, Andrea Barrett. We both wrote a novel at one time that happened to be set in the same place. And she made all sorts of stuff up. And I was like on the money about the thing. And I said, why did you do that? And she says, because I want the freedom to be able to make up things as I go along. And she said, why do you do what you do? And I says, because I want the freedom to be able to make up the other stuff. That is, if I can use geography and maps and history and use all this kind of reality, you will trust me when I get to the stuff that I really make up, which is these characters and why they do what they do. I'd rather convince you that road is a real road so that when this fellow over here says something that might not necessarily be believable, I have some credit with you as regards the reality of the place that I'm trying to invent. I'd rather spend my creative, my imagination on the things that I think really matter, which is the heart of your characters, than to also have to make up some fanciful geography. So if I can use things that already exist, you will believe me because there's more authority to that, and it will allow me to expend my energy on the stuff that's not real, like these bodies and these car chases and all this stuff. So.
Well, you talked about being free to make up characters.
Uh-huh.
And one of your characters several of your characters haunt me. Maybe you'll just say you can't talk about any of them. But one of them also in the Hunt Club is this African-American young woman who's a deaf mute.
Yeah.
And here's this white boy from a working class section of Charleston who's deeply in love with this, you know, extraordinarily gifted and extraordinarily handicapped woman of a different race in Charleston.
Who's on a postdoc at Stanford, by the
way. Right.
Who's being courted by Spavor and all the intelligence agencies, all the
U.S. government wants her to come.
She's extraordinarily intelligent.
But this could happen, and increasingly it does happen more and more, even in our region. But this is a leap, isn't it? This is real imagination. Or you want to say these characters are based on
actually,
real people?
No, you know, as we're talking, this whole thing springs from a hunting trip that I did at a hunt club with my best friend, Jeff Deal, a doctor who's an ENT down in Charleston. And he took me to this hunt club out in Jacksonboro, and this was back in the early 90s. And it was such a striking event that there were just all these things that I was just scooping up in my imagination. But that character, I cannot tell you where that character came from, because suddenly there was a girl who was worked for Unc at this hunt club. They owned a hunt club down in Jacksonboro, and that's where the hunt club comes from. And this girl and her mother, and the girl's about as Yuji's age, worked preparing breakfast and everything for all the hunters, all the blue blood doctors and lawyers that would come out to the property and go hunting. And there are moments when you let your imagination just take a rip and just go. And I really can't tell you where this girl came from. But I knew when she first appeared in the first novel that she was very endearing, and she was very smart. And she was going to be something like a foil to Yuji. Who thinks he knows everything but doesn't know anything. That's what you realize in the Hunt Club and also in Dead Low Tide. You have to have confidence that when something appears that you run with it and let it go. And, there was this moment in the Hunt Club when Yuji finally goes into her house. She lives in a trailer on the property down in Jacksonboro with her mom. And Yuji has all these assumptions about her. She's black. She's, you know, deaf and dumb. So, you know, of course she's nothing. And so as soon as he goes into her, walks into their house this particular morning after a set sequence of things have happened, first thing he sees is there are books. And this trailer is just, it's half trailer, half house. Every square inch is covered with books. Books, 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 books. And all of a sudden you begin to realize that this girl is not what she appears to be. And that's what I love to do in writing, is to let people have assumptions about things and then twist it so that you think is not really what it looks like. And I've always done that. I think that's what makes writing interesting. If all your characters are exactly who you thought they were going to be when you encountered them, then where's the fun in those characters?
Well, to cut me off if you don't want to go here, but there's another character that you in the new book, this guy who was a friend of Yuji growing up, who now has gotten a low level job,
Jessup,
who's kind of a nobody. Mm-hmm. At least we think that all the way through the book, and then, I mean, a cruel surprise. Change him in a moment into this extraordinarily gifted people. And is that part of your technique? Is you like surprises like that?
I do. I like to surprise. I think that the surprise. Okay, now I'm going to get real high tone here. I use this when I'm teaching. Is Henry James? Okay, Henry James. Henry James said that the story wasn't the rare human accident. Okay, that means the thing that happened. Okay, so he said a story isn't the thing that happened, the rare human accident. He said a story is the human attestation to it. That is how people see what happened. The thing isn't the thing that's important. It's how people perceive what has happened that is the real story. And so for me, plot is very important, but I think the revelation of the characters involved in the plot, the way they see what they are encountering, is much more interesting and is much more surprising. Yeah. And so when Jessup ends up being not what we thought Jessup was, I'm very happy with that. I had this as I was writing the book. I don't plot things out either. And as I was writing the book, all of a sudden there's this character named Jessup, and he had three or four different names because I couldn't really figure out who he was until he got the name Jessup. And don't ask me where that name came from, but I just all of a sudden he became this real guy, and then I realized oh about that fellow, and you know, the surprises about him, which are actually two or three different levels of surprise about him, became fun for me as a writer to discover.
And did you wind up liking Jessup even more than Eugene?
No, I love Eugene. I love Eugene. I love Eugene.
I know you
Unk
do, but
so much.
Well, did you love Jessup?
I really
more.
Admire Jessup. Jessup's a great guy. Jessup's a great guy.
Well, and I want to back up to your Henry James description of the story, which is really extraordinary. And is that we try all the time to try to figure out how to tell the difference between what is just popular fiction and literary mm-hmm. fiction. Mm-hmm. And are we on the trail of it to follow your description of how the story is not everything, it's how the characters mm-hmm. deal with the story. You're mm-hmm. getting closer to a character. Mm-hmm. It has a plot.
Yeah, I think that popular fiction, and this is not to disparage it in any way, but popular fiction, by and large, the reason you read popular fiction is for the plot. You want to see what happens. And you have characters, generally speaking, in popular fiction, and I'm not being hyperbolic or anything, but generally speaking, the character of the character of your characters is secondary importance to the plot. What's going to happen next? That's why you call it a page turner, because you're trying to find out what happens next. And I would say in literary fiction that the character, the revelation, the character involved in the story takes preeminence. Now, the problem is that can make for a really boring novel. So a real novel that incorporates both of those qualities, that is, real characters involved in a good plot, you know, that's the best book.
This is so interesting to me because, you know, you say I hadn't got all this mapped out in advance, and the characters kind of develop, and I hear a lot of really good writers, some of whom write boring books, who say I just let the characters take me where they're going, uh-huh. and there's a risk there if you just follow their lead that, you know, they're not crafty in necessarily, they might be crafty in determining their own lives, but they may mm-hmm. not be as crafty as you might be mm-hmm. in developing a plot that also carries you along and makes you interested in turning the pages, as you did in Dead Low Tide. Mm-hmm. So the question is, did you really not have this kind of mapped out in advance?
And what you said is it's risky, and that's the word I'm chewing on here, is because that's exactly right. People want to know when they sit down to write a book that it's going to work. And if they plot it out and they strategize enough and they figure everything out beforehand, I'm going to make it work. And then I write it down and it will work. It will have worked. When this is what separates people who, Flannery O'Connor said, most people want to have written. Okay?
Right.
Which means I'm already done with the work of it. Okay? But people want to believe that there's a way that I can do this and get a return on my investment before I ever embark on this thing. And when you writing is a crapshoot. It is always a crapshoot. You don't know if it's going to work or not. And my belief is that I want to have fun. I want to see what happens. I want to find out what this book is about. I get to be the first reader of this book. And if I enjoy the reading of it and I enjoy the surprise of it, I'm believing pretty much certain that somebody else is going to enjoy it as well. But if I sit there and hatch it all out and make it fit, it's going to be like, I bought this really beautiful pair of shoes. They didn't have my size, but man, they are beautiful shoes. And I'm going to walk uh-huh. around my feet squeezed into them and have blisters and everything. But don't my shoes look great? You know, that's not how it works. So there are ways to strategize. And Pat Conroy, when we go back to Pat Conroy, he plots things out he has it on big sheets of paper. But as he writes it, when the plot says, I'm not going to go there, he revises the plot. So that, to me, is a good way to do it, is that you always are ready and willing to take this thing where it's going to go. I like not knowing exactly where it's going to go, because that keeps me on the edge of my seat. And that's just, you know, to me, that's much more fun. If I'm feeling like I'm on the edge of my seat, I hope that you, the reader, will feel like you're on the edge of your seat, too.
Well, we're visiting with Brett Lott. We're talking about his latest novel, Dead Low Tide. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. During the break, our guest made a great point about when you learn or ought to learn that some of the characters who are going to surprise you, you might have a clue that they're going to surprise you.
Right.
Well, if you haven't plotted all this out in advance, how do you fix it if you haven't left the clues or the
revision. People think, again, you know, things just kind of spring out and it's all done, but it's in revision. And we were talking about Jessup and I don't want to give too much away, but he's a very important character. And our friend Granville here said that, or her husband pointed out that she had some little vibes about Jessup as we're going along through the book. And I said, that's exactly right. That's what you want to have. Because here's the thing about writing a mystery is that it's a very intriguing thing to do, because you have to write it so that it's not all spelled out, but your reader should be like a step ahead of the story. Your reader should be able to say, oh, yeah, okay, rather than being dragged along by a character who's kind of bushwhacking you left and right. But when you encounter these things, the main character usually isn't getting these things, but the reader should be getting a few things. Until the end, when there's a big surprise of any book, any suspense novel, the reaction should be surprise, but immediately following with a surprise, oh, yeah, I got it. You know, I saw that coming, but I didn't know that was coming. There was enough evidence throughout the thing for me to be able to understand what was going to happen, but it was a surprise when it happened. So there's a kind of logical surprise that you're trying to get. So in revision, you go back, and if you're flying by the seat of your pants, in revision, you go back and you prop things up and you put little arrows, you know, word arrows toward things, and just, you know, like sort of like highlight a little bit here and there so that your reader does pick up on these things.
Well, I want to shift gears.
Sure.
I do not want to shift gears, but I think I have to shift gears if we're going to talk about the other reason that you came to Chapel Hill, and that's to talk about books that you've edited and assembled of short stories with religious themes. And to introduce this, I just want to tell you I'm very puzzled because anybody who reads the introductions and the background information about your interest in religious themes understands that you're a deeply religious person, mm-hmm. and with a very extraordinarily deep faith, and one which you're unapologetic about talking about. Now, in the book that we've been talking about, there's no mention of God. Allah gets into this, but these people don't go to church. They don't talk. They don't say blessings before their meals. They're just out there without any religious connection. And so you've thought about this, mm-hmm. and you've been asked about this before.
My whole life, yeah.
yeah. I know other authors who are people of deep faith, but their characters, their books are neutral with respect, neutral in terms of specific church adherence. Uh-huh. Did you go to church?
I don't think so. I don't think necessarily. I think there's reference to, I think in the Hunt Club, where his mom, when he was little, made him go to Sunday school. I think that this is a question I've always struggled with. And when you say religious, and I think I'm a Christian. Okay, I'm a believer in Christ. So I'm not a generic religious dude. I mean, I believe in Christ as our Savior.
No, but I mean, you're active in the church. You go you're not just a believer. Like, for instance, one of our heroes, Reynolds Price, was a believer, mm-hmm. extraordinarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, and a deep believer, but he thought church was for. He just couldn't.
Nincompoops.
It just wasn't part of his.
Yeah.
But you're not like that.
No. C.S. Lewis said that the world doesn't need more little books about Christians. It needs more books by Christians with the Christian vision built into it. And my books are always about, they always end up being about. The quality of redemption and the quality of grace and the quality of forgiveness and the quality of sacrifice. And those things are things that are endemic, you know, systemic within a belief in Christ that this is why we're here and this is what we observe in the life of Christ and we observe in the teachings of Christ. And so I don't want to beat people over the head with the 2x4 of organized religion. I don't want to be soft and fuzzy and just kind of be generic about, you know, things. I want to tell real stories about real people who are having to deal with firsthand those matters that ought to be the fabric of who you are. And so that's I hold up Flannery O'Connor as one of my great heroes of faith and literature in that she held that a Christian is not going to write in terms of the Christian isn't going to create art that necessarily proselytizes. Or I'm a Protestant, okay? I'm a Baptist, and so there's oftentimes a great skepticism of art that isn't utilitarian, you know, that it ought to proselytize, and there ought to be a return on this. What are you doing here? Are you not trying to save souls for Christ? I'm not trying to save souls for Christ. What I'm trying to do is create. And with the integrity of Christ and the using the gift that I've been given to make a world in which those qualities that I mentioned are actually a part of the fabric and actually hold that world together. And that's basically true of every book that I've written.
Well, you're talking about Flannery O'Connor. You're mm-hmm. talking about your own faith. Mm-hmm. But there's a respect that crosses over at least— into Catholicism. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Catholics got it a lot better. They've got a lot better idea of the creation of art in service to God than the Protestants do.
Well, but it suggests that you, while you're not compromising your own faith, that you've got a high degree of tolerance for other people's way in which they approach their faith. Am I misreading that? Or are you? I mean, there are many Baptists who say, "No, my way or the highway, buddy." I mean, and not just being a Baptist, but Baptist and being of a certain particular belief structure.
Yeah, you know, I'm blessed to attend a church down in Charleston that has a wonderful fellowship that is there are particular people. And my pastor is one of those people. And so my belief in what I'm doing with my art isn't going to be, graded against Southern Baptist Convention. It's not, you know, held like that. It's more, you know, an understanding of the grace of God and in its many different manifestations. So, you know, I go to a great church. So my community, my community. Well, my wife and I went to a party the other night for a birthday for one of my colleagues at the college in the English department, and the place was flooded with professors and things. And my wife and I were so out of our water, out of our you know, what do you call it? What's the cliche? Out of our element. Yes, yes, yes. thank you, Grandma. And we walked away and we're kind of like, oh, you know what? I kind of would be fun to have all these people as colleagues. But then we remember is that our house is flooded with people from our church. You know, we have all this community over here, which isn't to say that's better than that one over there. But we share this kind of faith. We share this intimacy. I have to hightail it after I speak at church tomorrow because I got to get to my Sunday small group.
You know, oh, down in Charleston.
Back in Charleston. Well. So I think when you're propped up by people who love you and people who share a sense of the largeness of Christ and the particular role that the fact that people have particular roles in worshiping Christ and in sharing Christ, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Well, this is leads me just in terms of the supportive group that you've got. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about the Hunt Club mm-hmm. book that we talked about earlier is that that book got banned.
Or, yeah, that was very interesting.
I mean,
in Charleston.
And it because it was and
so
it was
you
because
did your research.
Because the I don't want to say because the this is not fair to say because the fundamentalists took it and thought it was it had all the bad language and all this stuff in it. And
no, it's not fundamentalists. It was one set of parents, and you know they. Cherry-picked the novel. Here's the thing. As being a Christian, I don't have a problem with using bad language because that's the reality. That's the reality of the world. If we were to go back, I really, you know, if we were to walk around with Christ at the time that he was living and hang out with the people that he hung out with, we upper-crust, you know, white Protestants would all faint. We'd drop dead. Saying you're kidding me? Christ is hanging out with those guys, and we read about it, and those stories become these iconic stories. But if we were to be in the middle of that, we wouldn't believe it. So it would be akin to Christ, you know, whatever you want to pick, whatever most vile you know thing we want to pick, that's where Christ was going
to
be.
We need to take a quick break. We're going to come right back to this. We're talking with Brett Lott about his book Dead Low Tide. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Brett Lott interrupted you as we were talking about the encounter that you had with respect to having your book, The Hunt Club, challenged because it was inappropriate for teenagers to read. And you were talking about Jesus and if he were here today, who he'd be mingling with. And mm-hmm. these would be people, I guess you were saying, who might not talk altogether in an acceptable way.
It would be the most marginalized people that we can think of now. That's who Christ would be hanging out with. And I always think of migrant workers. I think of illegal aliens, migrant workers. These who are people that we deal with and we accept in our community and we keep under the rug, and they serve us and they work for us, and that's where Christ would be hanging out. He'd be hanging out with tons of different things, but if we can think of the most downtrodden and most the people that we pay the least attention to, but who are with us, that's where he'd be. And it'd make us very uncomfortable. Anyway, the point was that the Hunt Club had been for years on the local high school reading list for summer reading as an option. And then a couple decided to challenge it in every which way they could for like six different committees until it finally went in front of the whole school board. And it was the first time in the history of Charleston's County School Board it was the first time since somebody protested Flowers for Algernon, which was in the 60s. So that was the first time that somebody had gotten enough, had appealed all the way to Caesar. Okay, it appealed all the way to Caesar. So I was called to go to this thing, and this couple made this giant PowerPoint presentation, had six screens around the whole room and everything, and they highlighted every bad word that I wrote and had it up on the screen in big bold letters, and then the mother read with gusto every one of these sentences, and I was kind of dying because I was like, you know, I wrote those words. Those are not good words. But if ever I could, you know, hide behind the whole idea of context, and I don't mean that I'm joking when I say hide. You know, when you pull things out of context, you are in no way giving us exactly what really was happening. And the point was that all the bad people are the people marching around with foul mouths. And there's actually in the rebuttal to it by the school board the librarian for the county, for the school district, pointed out that the only times that Eugene or Tabitha used foul language, they were reprimanded by either Tabitha's mom or Unc. So they tried it out, they were like, "There was a, you don't talk like that." So there was an underpinning of using that foul language to reveal that, you know, this isn't acceptable. But I'm never going to have a bad guy who says, "Gee whiz," that's just not going to happen.
Wouldn't happen.
No.
Well, in the results. Got a lot of attention to the book. Did it,
it
help
actually,
sales to the book?
It was wonderful. there was a big article in the paper the week or so before the county school board meeting and about the whole thing. And the book sold out on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. It sold out. So that's all, you know. I was hoping that they would actually ban it. Then we'd sell a ton of it. But the school board, and rightly, you know, realized that this is kind of ludicrous. So,
well, Brett Lott, thanks so much for
coming.
Thank
you so much.
Hill
thanks for this free-range conversation.
Well, I enjoyed it a lot, and I particularly enjoyed talking about your new book, Dead Low Tide, which you are here in Chapel Hill to promote. And I think you've gotten a lot of us excited about it. Thank you for your helpful comments about your faith and the relationship it has to your work. And we also, those of us who are part of the University Presbyterian community, thank you for your collection of short stories and insights that have come from our discussion.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. It's been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, and I'll be here right back before you know it.